Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement, as well as the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Today, I will give a very brief viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics that we'll be discussing, including but not limited to the death penalty, survivors of sexual and gender-based violence, and many other unhinged topics. Today, I am joined by somebody who I deeply admire, somebody who inspired me to continue my advocacy work in the true crime world, but also advocating for overturning wrongful convictions. Sarah, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Feel free to introduce yourself and the work that you do.
Hi, I'm Sarah Diarmond. Thank you so much for the very sweet introduction. I'm from Alabama. I run the nonprofit Voiceless Behind Bars, and I advocate for the wrongfully convicted, prison abolition, which, to be clear, does not mean I want to get rid of prisons. Means that prison dis system was designed to fail, and you can't fix what's meant to be broken, so you have to abolish it, rebuild it. But something that I do want to end is the death penalty, so I also advocate for that. And thank you again for that having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You began advocating for the wrongfully convicted since 2020, and you did go viral on TikTok and Instagram advocating for Sharon Edwards.
Correct.
Can you talk about that case specifically and what led you to begin advocating? What drawn you to that case?
Absolutely. So I went viral on Instagram, TikTok, early 2021 about Sharon's case. Instagram has been great when it comes to showing me clemency accounts, different people who've been wrongfully convicted, overly sentenced, and it showed me Sharon's clemency account, Free Sharon Edwards. So I looked at it, didn't see a lot of information, but something intrigued me. I thought, okay, well, let me Google it. And I found an article from Honeysuckle, and great website, by the way. And it said the dual sovereignty of Sharon Edwards. And for those of you who don't know, dual sovereignty means that you could be sentenced to, like in his case, 20 years in state prison and 20 years in federal prison. So he had already done 20 years in federal prison. Currently doing 20 years in state prison for a very minor crime. And he was targeted by a Klansman who David Lindley. I mean, this is public record. He's even in the book, The History of the Mississippi Klan, so I'm not slandering anyone. But he wore his Klan robe to work in 1998, year before he targeted Sharon. So, but yeah, I read all of that. I was furious, and I emailed his account. And I'm like, and I asked, what can I do to help? And his family, who runs the account, said, oh, just spread the word. And I said, okay. And I got on camera, and the result you see is me at the height of my frustration, because back then, videos on TikTok and Instagram, it was 60 seconds max, and I kept getting cut off. So the final result is just me very frustrated, but it made for a good video. And that's when it went viral, and it got one of his best friend's attention, my friend Adrian. He put it on his page, which got more attention, and it led me to Terrence, who is the son of Timothy McGruder, who I became the head advocate for. He reached out to me to look into his father's case, who is wrongfully and illegally incarcerated, and that got the ball rolling into what I'm doing today full time, and also got the ball rolling to me opening my own nonprofit.
Absolutely. And I think we all start somewhere, and turning how you're feeling about these cases into action, I think is deeply inspiring and deeply incredible. And I want to talk about your nonprofit. So Voiceless Behind Bars in November of 2021, and your therapist actually came up with the idea and you ran with it.
Yeah, He had suggested it to me earlier that year, and I thought, wait, really? You think I can do that? And he said, I do. And I'm like, let me pray about it. And after a few months, I said, I think I can do it. And he said, he suggested the site LegalZoom, which helps get rid of the middleman. But he did encourage me with that, and I'm because he also is very encouraging when it comes to social justice issues, something he cares about and very thankful for. And I kept the name Voice of Spine Bars, got that trademarked because Terrence said to me when he first reached out to me about his dad, he said to me, he just wants to be heard. And I froze when I read those words, and I thought to myself, how many people right now are in prison who have been wrongfully convicted and no one's listening to them? And I just sat there and I just stared at those words, and I thought, and finally I said to Terrence, okay, I'll look into it. But those words always stood with me, so that's how I came up with Voice of Spine Bars. And yep.
I think it's incredible. I interview a lot of people, and you're one of the first people that connected with me with the movement, amongst like the first like couple like 100 followers. And you've watched the movement grow, and you've been a big supporter, and I'm grateful that I've connected with you.
Me
And
too.
for those of you out there, I was actually on Sarah's podcast as well, which you can also listen to on all the streaming platforms as well back in May. And we talked about like abolition. We talked about a number of things. Capitalism is something that I hit very hard on. But, overall, you've just been a big supporter of the movement. So thank you for that.
Oh,
And
absolutely. I'm very glad to have watched this grow and very thankful to be part of this with you. I'm very proud of you and what you've been able to accomplish, and I can't wait to see what more you have in store for us.
yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot more coming. I have a fantastic team, and I wouldn't want to do anything else. And
Exactly.
whatever I think about, different cases, I think about people that I've been following for a very long time that were wrongfully incarcerated. And one of them is Patty Pruitt out of Missouri. And the reason that this case, well, not only did I grow up in Missouri, but I'm always going to be a Missourian. And there was an article from KCUR that was talking about during her 38 years in a Missouri prison, Patty Pruitt maintained hope in her innocence. This was an article written on May 30th of 2025. KCUR is the local NPR channel in Kansas City. In December, then Missouri Governor Mike Parson commuted the life sentence of Patty Pruitt, who had already spent 38 years behind bars for a crime she maintains she did not commit. Now she's out with a new book, Trying to Catch Lightning in a Jar: Letters from Prison. Then on December 20th, 2024, she was released from prison when then Missouri Governor Mike Parson commuted her sentence, which had been 50 years without parole. Legal experts were working on seeking her exoneration right up until the day the clemency order came. During her nearly 40 years behind bars, Pruitt wrote letters to friends, family, and journalists. From cycling, that's a weird word to say. I always mess up on it. Everything from deplorable prison conditions to the pain of missing her children. Now, I've connected with the daughter, and been watching the journey. I haven't talked to her like a whole lot just yet, but I would absolutely love to. But there was also a documentary that came out about Patty Pruitt as well. That's called 33 and Counting, which is a true crime story about 70-year-old grandmother from rural Missouri serving a life sentence for a murder she says her rapist committed. And again, being a survivor myself, I feel connected to the Patty Pruitt case. Patty Pruitt is a devoted mother to her four living children and grandmother of her 13 grandchildren. Since 1986, Patty was serving a life sentence for the murder of her husband. She refused a plea deal and maintained her innocence throughout. She was a model inmate. Patty earned multiple academic diplomas, serving the state as a computer programmer, and was a leader in prison performing arts, restorative justice, and residents encounter Christ. Thinking about the impact that Patty's, story has had on our communities and has had on the world, learning about her exoneration, I was extremely excited, learning about her story. And she was actually Missouri's longest serving female prisoner in history. Thinking about that, how many other cases have you heard that are similar to this? And I'll do more of a deep dive into her case here in a second. But you've been doing this work for, the last, what, 5 years, give or take?
5 years, yeah.
And unfortunately, this case is far too common.
It's very common. I was just now thinking of several cases very similar to hers. There are, let's see, when it comes to women who are incarcerated for killing their abusers in self-defense only, they make up, depending on the state, 40 to 70% of the prison population. But when it comes to also just, doesn't matter the gender, when it comes to wrongfully convicted cases, just like hers, I could just think of so many that came to mind, including in Missouri. And don't get me wrong, it happens all over the country. Missouri, I know a lot of people who have been wrongfully convicted, whose cases are not only similar to hers, but the mentality is also very similar, where they maintain hope, they maintain just a positive outlook, even though some days, of course, are harder than others, but they stay in contact with their family. They are devoted parents, grandparents. They keep focused on rehabilitating themselves, such as different like they said taking different classes. They are able to get involved in group therapy. I know people who are able to develop these craftsman skills where they make the most beautiful purses, jewelry, and just like with Patty, they maintain such a beautiful and positive impact outlook on life, where I'm like, if I were in prison that long, I don't know if I would. So I can just think of several cases where she reminds me of people I advocate for, but also the cases itself.
And whenever we learned about the news of Patty coming home, because on December 20th of 2024, Patty and her children received that Christmas miracle. And Patty, she's home with her family after 38 and a half years of painful separation. And I want to do a deep dive into this case really quick. So allow me to walk through this
Please
from
do.
a grossly inadequate investigation. And this is on the pattypruitt.com website. From the earliest moments of the investigation, police focused on Patty as the prime suspect. They ignored credible leads pointing to an intruder and failed to collect key evidence that could identify the individual who assaulted Patty Pruitt and murdered her husband. The result was an investigation married by tunnel vision, a common cause of wrongful convictions. These errors by investigators are not Patty's fault, but Patty and her family are paying, did pay the ultimate price. To secure a conviction, the state relied on the testimony of a discredited pathologist who mischaracterized forensic evidence to make Patty appear guilty. To move the jury, the prosecutor falsely portrayed Patty as a bad mother. The prosecutor mockingly referred to Patty's defense as one that relied on an intruder conducting the murder, quote, to enjoy Miss Pruitt's oft-enjoyed sexual favors. Jurors were not told of a neighbor's account of a suspicious vehicle near the Pruitt home the night of the murder. The prosecutor instructed jurors that the dignity of the institution of marriage required a conviction. Her attorney, or her trial attorney, which is a retired judge, Robert Byard, stated, "Based on my decades of experience in the courtroom, I have no doubt that the jury would not have convicted Patty had they heard the neighbor's account of the suspicious vehicle. This was the missing link to our defense and the missing evidence for the jury." During her 38 years in prison, Patty maintained her multiple, or she obtained multiple academic diplomas, serving the state as a computer programmer and volunteered thousands of community service hours. Essentially, she accomplished more and given more and touched the lives of more individuals than people that are on the outside of that will ever achieve in their lifetime. And that's the reality of that. And I'm honestly surprised that Governor Parson granted her clemency, knowing his history and knowing, he is a former police officer himself. He's a former sheriff in rural Missouri. He's no longer the governor. Thank God.
Oh, he's not the governor. I didn't know
No,
that.
so
Oh.
last year, his lieutenant governor, Governor Mike Kehoe, became the governor of Missouri. And for those of you who don't know, I am from the state of Missouri. I know a lot about these two individuals, to say it lightly. But, I remember how I felt whenever I heard the news. I got really excited, and I was extremely, happy to watch her, walk out of that prison as a free woman. And she should have never been prosecuted to begin with. And as that prosecuting, or as that attorney said, the prosecution left out a lot of key evidence. And unfortunately, again, this has happened a very, quite a bit. And there's another case that I think of in Missouri, the case of Kevin Strickland. And he was convicted by an all-white jury in 1979 of killing three people in Kansas City, Missouri. Kevin Strickland was born on June 7, 1959. And there was no physical evidence that linked him to the scene of the crime. And the only alleged witness later recanted her testimony that Strickland was involved, stating that she was coerced by police. Strickland was given a life sentence. In 2021, he garnered national attention after former prosecutors in his case said that he was innocent and called for his release. Two black men who pled guilty to the murders have said Strickland was not involved, and a fingerprint from the shotgun used in the murders belonged to someone else. Cynthia Douglas, the sole eyewitness to the crime, said detectives pressured her into naming Strickland as a perpetrator. She attempted several times to recant her testimony before her death in 2015. Numerous legal and political figures called for Strickland's exoneration. In June of 2021, the Supreme Court of Missouri denied a petition to have him released. The governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, refused to pardon him, saying he did not see his case as a priority and was not certain of his innocence. The Missouri Attorney General fought in court to keep him in prison, saying he believed he was guilty. On November 23rd, 2021, Judge James Welsh overturned Strickland's conviction, quote, since it was not based on physical evidence, but on eyewitness testimony, who later recanted her account, and Strickland was released on the same day. He was exonerated after more than 42 years in prison, making his case the longest confirmed wrongful conviction case in Missouri's history. Happy to report he is doing well. He obviously he's out of like the like obviously off the news, and like he's living his life, but he served more than 42 years in prison, and he did experience a couple heart attacks. He has high blood pressure. His ability to stand is diminished. His father died in 2011. His mother, Rosetta Thornton, died on August 21st, 2021. So she did not get to see her son be exonerated. And prior to his exoneration, Strickland stated upon his release that he wanted to see the ocean. That's just something that he always wanted to do. He always wanted to see it. So Again, thinking about these cases, what are your reactions and what have you seen? What other cases do you want to highlight that people should absolutely pay attention to? And are there any that are coming up for parole, any coming up for, clemency or anything like that that you can think of that you want to highlight?
There is well, I guess the right off the top of my head, I talked to him this morning, Timothy McGruder, and I mentioned him just earlier, but I've been head advocate on his case since 2021, and his case was, I mean, just there. It's just I remember someone on the petition had commented it was so sloppy from the beginning, and they are correct. There were so many illegal loopholes that the prosecutor went through, which is very common, very common. I mean, you just went over that just now, what the prosecution will do. Same with his case. I mean, before he was arrested, the prosecutor in his case, Jeff Paulson, okay, I'm not toning down at all the tragedy of this case. That's not what I'm doing. I'm saying, legally speaking, it met the requirements of a state case. However, he really wanted to make it a federal case, and although he wasn't legally able to, I mean, law does not apply to law enforcement. This includes prosecutors. So he still ordered the feds to arrest Timothy and his co-defendants without indictments, without federal jurisdiction, legal term. And so, at which was brought up in trial, but the judge allowed that to slide. Judge allowed a lot of things to slide, including the fact that Timothy's attorney showed up 30 minutes after trial had begun, which is a big no, but and recently, Timothy did file, and when I say recently, I mean about 8 months ago. This court still hasn't made a decision, which no news is good news sometimes, but Timothy did file a motion against the judge that he had involuntarily dismissed his right to counsel. And his case was very politically motivated. This was 2002, an election year, and everyone involved in the case climbed up the political ladder, and there's no DNA. There were no I oh, there were eyewitnesses, but they didn't identify Timothy. They identified different people, but there was no physical evidence, nothing. Timothy had an alibi. The only way they were able to convict him was based on the plea deals the prosecutor made with three people. And that was it was just solely based on hearsay evidence. And so Timothy has been in prison. It'll be 25 years in December. He will be 50 this month, so nearly it'll be half his life soon. And but what I have found to be, first of all, the case itself makes me want to scream, but when it comes to Timothy, I just find him to be not only a really sweet man, he's just like so full of life. When my friends have heard my interviews with them, they've been amazed that, he by a sense of humor. And like when I've been down, when I've lost a loved one, he's been there for me. Whatever he's going through, he's like, no, open up to me, talk to me, what's going on? And when it comes to his son Terrence, who I mentioned earlier, reached out to me. Timothy has always stayed active in his son's life. Terrence is the best thing that's ever happened to him. He's crazy about his grandkids, and Timothy is a family man. He remains close to the sisters, his mom. And also, despite the fact that he was wrongfully convicted, he does take responsibility for the things he did do wrong. He has told me from day one that again, while he did not commit this crime, which was the murder of a 4-year-old girl, so she's the victim in all this. And worst thing about this, whoever did this is still out there. So, but which gets to us both, because we do want whoever did this to be in prison.
Absolutely.
But he did tell me that, he wasn't a gang, and he's been very forthcoming about that. And he said to me, 5 to 10 years in prison was necessary for him to, he said to me he didn't need some slap in the wrist. The path he was headed down, now he needed some prison time, and I agreed with him. And we had talked about that, and he said to me, I just he's never made excuses for that. He said to me that's the biggest mistake of his life. And while, again, not saying this justifies his wrongful conviction, but cause and effect, he said it was this path he went down that led him here. And I understand that. He said to me one of the things he wants to do when he gets out is help out people who were, like in neighborhoods like his, and do outreach programs, because there's not enough of those, and he wants to let them know there's always a better way. And it's one of the many things that just amazes me about him is that he maintains these high spirits, these goals for himself, and he's never ever lost hope.
And you say a key word is hope. What does hope look like to Timothy?
So hope to him, has always been his family. Like I said, he's a family man, his son, his grandkids, his mom, his sisters. He's got a very big, loving, supportive family who has been standing by him, advocating for him. Like his cousin was his star witness, who was there. I was reading the transcripts, and he was by his side that whole night, and his cousin has always stood by him. And so his family's provided him hope, and seeing the support he gets on social media, seeing the kindness of others, has also given him hope. Also getting to take part in getting an education and learning how to, like I said, I mentioned this earlier, but he makes the most beautiful purses, out of leather, alligator skin, ostrich skin, makes jewelry, and he has developed a passion for that. And he mentors to the other inmates. So hope with helping others, hope with his own passions, and knowing that others have faith in him, keeps him going.
Absolutely, I want to give a backstory on what I've learned about Timothy Magruder and about his case. Okay, so in 1996, there had been a gang that had opened fire on a vehicle that was parked in front of an Amoco gas station in St. Paul, Minnesota. They thought this vehicle contained members of a rival gang inside of it. They were mistaken and instead murdered a 4-year eight more murdered a 4-year-old little girl. And this is the girl that you mentioned about. Despite a large cash reward offered for any information that would lead to answers regarding this heartbreaking murder, no one said a word to the police for fear of retaliation from any of the gang members involved. The case ended up going cold. In 2001, three gang members, Teron, Greg, and Malik, were arrested for their involvement in drug trafficking for 10 years. The federal prosecutor, Jeff Paulson, wanted to connect the drug conspiracy they were involved into the murder of the little girl. Now it's essential to understand that the murder of the little girl by itself met the qualifications of a state case only, and this is what you were talking about just a little bit ago, but combined with drug trafficking across state lines, it would be turned into a federal case, thus under Jeff Paulson's jurisdiction. Jeff Paulson was well known for targeting gang members and going for the harshest punishment, life in federal prison without parole. He would typically put three gang members on trial together, sensationalizing the cases. So now, with Tehran, Gray, and Malik facing life in prison, they were offered plea deals in exchange for information about who had murdered the girl at the Amco gas station. They claimed it had been members of a rival gang, one that Timothy was a member of, without any evidence or proof that they had any connection to her murder. But as long as they handed over any name, Jeff Paulson just needed to find a way to connect Timothy, Camille, and Keith. All three had been framed to the drug conspiracy to make it a federal case legally. Although he could not do so, Jeff Paulson still ordered the feds to arrest Timothy, Camille, and Keith without federal jurisdiction. Wow.
That's correct.
And what's also correct is I know exactly where this Amco gas station is. I used to live in Minneapolis and frequented St. Paul quite a bit. I know exactly where this gas station is. Wow. I just didn't know that there was, I didn't know about this case at that time. And this is wild. And that is directly from a change.org petition that people can sign. And I see that it's still active. Is that correct?
It is still active.
Okay. And it's just wild. It really is. It's just absolutely wild. And oh, you're the starter of the petition.
That's right.
So, I'm learning this in real time and just learning more about this case. And, I believe in fight the authentic voices and finding out, what's truly happening in our communities. So, thank you again for the work that you're doing to help Timothy. And
Thank you for giving this a platform because, this not only was a great miscarriage of justice, not just on Timothy's end, but he and I've talked about this more than once, and we don't talk about it as extensively because it's a difficult subject. We don't want to be disrespectful, but we do want justice for this little girl. We really do. She, like I said, she's the real victim in all this, and again, I can't stress this enough, and this is so common with wrongful convictions, not just his case. The real killer's still out there. And I know that with Timothy's case. Whoever did it is still out there. We're not going to speculate because I don't want to potentially put someone in the same position he's in, but I just know, but yeah, whoever did it is still out there, and that more than likely they've killed again, which is again is common. And we want actual justice, not just for him, but for her. And just nobody wins with a wrongful conviction. Nobody. Not the taxpayers, not the people who were wrongfully convicted, not the victim. No one.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely correct. And if they've done this to this girl, they most likely and more than likely did it again. You're absolutely right. And God only knows, right? And it's just an ongoing issue that a lot of people are not talking about either. But
Because wrongful convictions are common. Very, at least according to the Equal Justice Initiative, at least two people a day are wrongfully convicted.
I always have an issue whenever I learn that somebody who the way that these systems are designed, Sarah, and this as well as I do, and I've advocated for people within the systems, but on a different level, not like abolition or anything like that, but on the mental health side. And you
Oh, yeah.
oftentimes see like a cross in between that because people who have a mental health diagnosis are also incarcerated
Oh, yeah.
at astronomical rates or disabled or, survivors of sexual and gender-based violence or assault. And oftentimes we hear about that. And, I think about the case of Santoya Brown. That case kind of stood out to me quite a bit. She murdered her trafficker and she was wrongfully incarcerated. And I think about that. Now she's like a published author and a speaker, and she was convicted of robbing and murdering the person who bought her from sex trafficking. And she did quite a bit of time in prison. I remember hearing about this case because she went in at prison at the age of 16.
Dude.
And I think about this, and I remember watching the Santoya Brown story on Netflix and learning about it, and that like it kind of opened my eyes quite a bit. And she is now 37 years old, and she was granted clemency by Governor Bill Haslam, who was the governor of, I believe, Tennessee. Yeah, so he was the governor of Tennessee from 2011 to 2019. He granted her clemency, so I was glad to see that. But I also remember watching a lot of her case, as I was younger, and a little bit of a backstory. Her father is unknown. Her biological mother, Georgina Mitchell, drank alcohol during her pregnancy. Brown's defense attorneys would later claim that that caused her to develop fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD. Following Brown's birth, Mitchell began to use cocaine. Unable to care for her infant daughter, Mitchell placed the child up for adoption. And she spent time with the state's Department of Children's Services between April 2001 and September of 2003 after committing crimes against the person and crimes against property, according to spokeswoman Carla Aaron. Then it just continued. While in the custody of the DCS, Brown spent 2 years in DCS facilities, including a year at Woodland Hills Youth Development Center in Nashville. She fled these facilities several times, eventually ending up as a runaway on the streets of Nashville in August of 2004. While a runaway, or quote unquote, we also know that that's oftentimes a loosely and like a loose-ended term. Brown met Garion L. McLaughlin, also known as street name Cutthroat, often abbreviated to Cut or Cut, or with a K and with a C, who began trafficking Brown. During this time, she lived at InTown Suites Hotel. Brown supported McLaughlin and her testament and herself via involuntary prostitution as a victim of domestic minor sex trafficking. According to Brown, McLaughlin threatened, beat, and raped her on multiple occasions. On the night of August 6, 2004, 16-year-old Santoya Brown met 43-year-old Johnny Michael Allen in the parking lot of a Sonic drive-in on Murfreesboro Road in Nashville, Tennessee. Allen was a real estate agent. He also was a youth pastor and a Sunday school teacher, and had started a homeless ministry at a local Baptist church. According to a detective on the case, Allen asked if she was hungry and if she was up for any action. The detective asserted that Brown answered yes to both questions and accepted Allen's offer to take her to his house. Brown and Allen ordered dinner, and Allen drove the pair to his home. At a later hearing, Brown testified that she agreed to have sex with Allen for $150, but claimed that they would never actually engage in sexual intercourse. Allen's friends and family denied that he had tried to solicit Brown for sex, instead claiming that he was trying to help her. However, the lead prosecutor in the case, Jeff Burke, stipulated that Allen picked Brown up to pay her for sex, stating that was a fact from start to finish. In court documents, another minor who was a waitress at a local restaurant claimed that she and the other young teens at the restaurant felt uncomfortable whenever they had to serve Allen. The waitress said that he would hit on the teens regularly. At some point during the encounter, Brown shot Allen in the back of the head using her 40 caliber handgun. She then stole $172 from Allen's wallet and two of his firearms and fled the scene in Allen's truck, allegedly. Brown left Allen's truck at a Walmart parking lot and flagged down an SUV for a ride home. Police later found Brown and McLaughlin at the nearby InTown Suites. Brown was arrested and charged with homicide, aggravated robbery, handgun possession, and criminal impersonation. Despite being only 16 at the time of the killing, she was tried as an adult. This decision came from Metro Juvenile Court Judge Betty Adams Green on November 14, 2004, who argued that it was much too much, or was, who argued that it was too much of a risk to keep the community, or much of a risk to the community to keep the 16-year-old in the juvenile court system. So reading about this case and, watching the documentary that I watched, this case kind of like hit a little hard too, just for like obvious personal reasons. But hearing about the case of Santoya Brown, what's your reactions? Because obviously we got a problem.
I hear about this a lot. I hear about this very often, where not only where woman or the girl kills her abuser in self-defense only, and she is put in prison, but also they're a victim of sex trafficking. They're all like, I'm like, there's domestic violence, sex trafficking, and again, they are there. It's self-defense, and yet they're the ones who are being punished. I there's a one a documentary I watched on Netflix about a woman named Brittany here in Alabama who killed a rapist in self-defense, and she was still had to take a plea deal. It's been 5 years in prison, and for first degree murder. Though again, this man raped her, she was trying, this was self-defense only, and so, but all I just hear about this, I just, again, not only quite often, but I just, not only does this hardly ever make the news, but what you hear make the news is, oh, these two promising young men, they threw their future's done with, who, and their media sympathizing with the men who raped woman like Brock Turner, Drew Clinton, and they get these very lenient sentences, but again, the media is siding with them. And we get it all the time. People are angry with us, like, well, you're against the death penalty. What about the victims? Well, we care very much about the victims. In fact, people like people we just mentioned should be the ones in prison instead of people who are wrongfully convicted. They're the ones who should be in prison. We shouldn't be all these promising young men, giving this slap on the wrist. No, they're the ones who should be getting these harsh sentences, not like Sherron Edwards, 40 years in prison for a minor crime. And we should be, like, sex trafficking is a big problem in this country that still isn't being talked about. It's a big problem in Alabama, where I live. And again, a lot of us are doing volunteer work about it. We're trying to get laws passed, like closing the boyfriend loophole, for instance. A lot of politicians just aren't interested. So again, it does ups it is it does hit it does hit me hard as well, because I'm thinking, okay, why aren't more people talking about this? Where's the people who claim to care about the victims? Because you're right here. We need your help.
Exactly. And I think that's a key part in all of this, right? Is, if you see something, say something. And if you feel connected to a case, advocate for that case, and help them get justice. And I creating the Rise of Justice movement is more than just a movement. It's brought people together, like you, me, and countless of others and survivors and advocate organizations and other movements, all alike. And we all have one common thing in mind, and it's literally justice. But literally rising above that justice and becoming a part of a movement just means, we all come together and we fight for the same causes, but also different causes too, but also focusing on the intersectionality of all of it. And
Absolutely.
I believe wholeheartedly that everything is connected and it's all by design. Oftentimes we hear a system is broken. How can a system be broken when it's functioning exactly how it was designed? It's
Exactly.
literally by design. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And to anybody out there who's listening, Sarah, where can they find you on social media?
So you can find me It's Sarah Only. That's all one word. ITSSARAHONLY. It's Sarah Only on TikTok, Instagram, and Threads. And you can find me on Facebook, Sarah DiArmond, and my nonprofit, Voiceless Behind Bars, has its own business page on Facebook, voicelessbehindbars.org. And yeah, you can find me on there. Please follow me. And would love to chat with you. Any questions you have about any cases, anything you would like to bring to my attention, maybe interview somebody, please let me know. Let's chat.
Absolutely. Sarah, thank you so much, my friend. Please take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. You have an open invite anytime you have anything to talk about, any developments in the cases, you know where to find us, you know where to find me. Again, my name is Zachary Mallory, and thank you all for joining us on the Rise of Justice Movement podcast. Sarah, have a fantastic night.
You too. Thank you.